We now come to our first place winner, who actually also happens to be our also an honorable mention winner. This is, and I'll just so happens that these stories, when we judge the contest, we don't know who writes the stories. We judge the stories blind, and I think this is really important. And we actually selected 5 finalists to send to Nicole, our judge. And we didn't realize this, but 2 of them were by the same person. And he's an honorable mention winner, and he's also the first place winner. And this is Jason K. Friedman. His story is called Blue. It'll be in the next issue of Moment. He flew in tonight from San Francisco. His short fiction has appeared in literary magazines and anthologies, including Best American Gay Fiction. He has published 2 children's books, a thriller called Phantom Trucker, and the nonfiction Haunted Houses. He works as a technical writer in San Francisco. And we're very excited about his story, Blue.
I'm going to read the first few pages of my story, and if I haven't done a good enough job setting up the subject of the story in the story itself, I'm not going to cheat by trying to sneak in a few words of introduction setting the stage. So instead, let me take a few seconds to thank the Karma Foundation and Moment Magazine, which is a wonderful magazine of progressive Jewish thought, for this honor and for supporting Jewish short fiction. And thank Nicole Krauss, whose work I am obviously not alone in admiring, and Sala Levin for her tireless organizing of this contest and her tireless organizing of me, which is not an easy task, as she will tell you. And just to thank everybody associated with this competition for their encouragement, which is truly, truly the real prize for me. So thanks. Okay, so Blue. The adults had been there for hours. The ones from out of town had been there for days, and they all seemed drunk and happy, huddled in little groups that opened up whenever I passed to let me in. They were offering me a space to stand there and receive their hail hellos and congratulations and slurred life advice. I smiled gamely and kept walking through my grandparents' house, through the sunroom, past the living room picture window, past the silver platters of food, the crystal decanters with little name tags chained around their necks. I had nowhere to go. I had changed out of my bar mitzvah suit into an aqua leisure suit with a polyester shirt depicting a crowded seafloor scene. I had blow-dried and sprayed my hair into a kind of helmet. I was ready for someone my age to show up. I was ready for a miracle to take place and a cool bar mitzvah party to assemble on the screen back porch. A bar mitzvah was, after all, a religious celebration, and in those days it was religion alone that lifted me out of despair, inspiring in me the fervid hope that everything would be all right. I happened to be in the foyer to witness the spectacle of Aaron Elkins making his entrance. It was July, it was Savannah, my grandparents' air conditioner had broken, and so the attic fan was on. I stood in the insuck of hot air through the open front door and watched Aaron navigate his way up the crisscrossed red brick walkway. Massive cockroaches illuminated in the front porch lights flew across his path, causing him to skip and dodge and do a minstrel-like little dance. At one point, his hands shot up and his palms pressed against either side of his head. He had been born a blue baby and was a fellow regular at the first table by the steps in the lunchroom pit. He struck me as a puny and contemptible figure, but I was grateful he had come. He didn't see me till he got to the front steps. He said, "There's about 1 million cockroaches out there." He had stopped on the front porch and was wiping his forehead with a shredded Kleenex. The corners of his purple mouth tilted down in a textbook frown. His shoulders were hunched, his entire physical presentation reflecting the effort it took him simply to get there. "Well, about 999,000 left. I stomped about 1,000 of them. Oh, unless they've been doing it." He leered at me. I'm sure that was the intent as he stood there catching his breath. "Then there'd be more of them than when I got here. Have you ever seen 2 gigantic flying cockroaches doing it?" "Come in," I said, taking a deep breath against an impending flow of tears. This was only my first guest. I had an entire night to endure. "Are there any girls here yet?" he asked, stepping under the fanlight, his yellow eyes aglow under the blazing chandelier. Getting girls to come to a party hosted by me was a known problem whose solution I had left in God's hands. "You've got pieces of Kleenex stuck to your forehead," I said. He raked his forehead with his long, bluish nails, then did his version of a grin. "Which girls did you invite?" "All of them." Who was I to exclude anyone in the class? "Leslie Lee?" he asked. I said, "All of them." "Ooh, Leslie Lee," he said dreamily, his eyes closing. Then he opened them and grabbed a hold of an invisible pair of skinny hips, pulling them into his groin three times as he goatishly intoned each syllable of her last name, De Bouillons. "Come on," I said, looking around in case anyone had seen. I took him through the kitchen. "You look like you're about to cry," he said from behind. I didn't reply. In the kitchen, the two maids, ours and my grandparents, looked up from the trays of hors d'oeuvres they were arranging and smiled simultaneously. This struck me as a kind and classy gesture for which I felt absurdly grateful. My mother was giving them orders from against the kitchen sink and ignored me. My luck ran out in the dining room. Everyone was engaged talking with someone else except for Harry Sandman, my godfather, who was standing at the window looking out at the garden. The other men were wearing coats and ties, but he was wearing a striped sports shirt and a pair of slacks, as if to call attention to his bachelorhood to confirm all the rumors. The reason he lived in a carriage house downtown, my parents said, was to be closer to the whores he ran with. The carriage house was a block away from the auto repair garage he owned, but they considered this a secondary convenience. It never occurred to me to ask why they chose such a person to be my godfather. He turned just as I passed behind him, pinning me and Aaron to the dining room table. His hairline started very high on his head. Below that, he had a deep reddish tan and spots like watermelon seeds here and there. "Ho, ho, the bar mitzvah boy. Look at that shirt. That's a voyage to the bottom of the sea." He put his arm around me, then stuck out the other one at Aaron. "Harry Sandman, glad to meet you." No response. "Did you know I held this kid in my hands?" Aaron shook his head, and it was unclear whether he meant yes or no. "I had his legs spread as wide as I could. I was holding down his fat little calves. This kid was a kicker. One wrong move and he'd have been a little girl. Do you follow me?" Aaron laughed at this. "Who's your daddy?" Harry asked. "Simon Elkins." "Sure I know who Simon Elkins is. Tell him hello. Tell him to bring his car into the garage for a checkup. On the house, free of charge. What is it, a black Dodge Dart station wagon? 69, 70? 69, heh heh," Aaron said, recognizing a kindred spirit. Harry looked at him for a second, then broke into a smile. "Your friend's got a dirty mind," he said into my face, "and one hell of a tan." "Well, we better get to the porch," I said. I like that in a boy. I was wondering if Harry meant the dirty mind or the tan when he kissed me on the lips. He tasted of pickles and booze. "I like you too. This is a hell of a party you're throwing here. I think there are more people here than came to the thing this morning. Hey, Aaron, did you hear how this kid reads Hebrew like a professional?" "Yeah," Aaron said sourly. "He read it for 3 hours straight." Harry considered this. "He did read for 3 hours straight, didn't he? It sure seemed like it if he didn't." "It was a double parsha," I said in my defense. I was defending myself, but I didn't feel defensive. I had known what I was doing. The moon's position in the sky accounted for why a double portion needed to be read from the Torah that day, but I alone was responsible for the hours of uninterrupted, practically tuneless Hebrew chanting coming off the altar. The cantor, my bar mitzvah coach, had suggested we do excerpts of the two long readings, a little here, a little there, then on to something else. I said we'd do it the way God wrote it, and it wasn't a medley. The cantor, who'd escaped a Polish labor camp, eaten the soles of his shoes, hidden in the bare branches of trees, avoided being shot thanks to a miraculous nick of time snowfall, sighed. "No one stands there for more than 2 hours straight reading from the Torah," he said, "especially at our middle-of-the-road synagogue, which prouded itself on not being crazy liberal, but not being crazy Orthodox either." "In addition to being unusual," he said, to paraphrase his elegant, accented English, reading the two sections in their entirety and in Hebrew would bore the shit out of the congregation. I knew he was right, but I would not be swayed. To keep us on some kind of schedule, we had cut out my "Today I am a man" speech. We had cut out the rabbi's speech. We had cut out the part where the Zaftig, Elizabeth Taylor-esque sisterhood president, Mrs. Glass, hands me a silver cup. We had cut out everything that could possibly be considered entertainment at a bar mitzvah. The day came, and I stood there reading the ancient words, feeling God's breath rise up from my lungs and pass through my lips, and occasionally looking up and registering the emptying sanctuary. The endless lines of ancient, unpunctuated consonants, some of them crowned, rose and seemed to hover above the parchment, the letters black and watery, but crisp-edged. And when I looked up, I couldn't make out faces, only the movement of bodies toward the door. At first, they left one at a time, maybe pretending to go to the bathroom or have a smoke. Then they left in pairs. And then, abandoning all shame, they left in groups of three and four and more. I looked up for the last time when I was nearing the end, the part where the Hebrews, camped on the far side of the Jordan, within sight of the Holy Land, listened to Moses relay God's commandments on whom their daughters may marry. The front two rows were still filled with family, zombie-eyed and dutiful, but the rest of the sanctuary was empty, but for an odd man here and there, like the audience at a midnight showing of a Czechoslovakian animated film. I don't know where the rest of the guests had gone, but they all reappeared in the social hall when it was time to eat. Thanks. Thank you.